This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. This is episode number 2, and I'm actually really excited about this episode because we are talking about family therapy today, more specifically, family therapy models. There is a long history in family therapy of model rivalry, and we're going to try and subvert that today. And I'm doing that by inviting a friend and colleague, Bryson Greaves, into studio. And Bryson is an emotionally focused therapist. I practice from a narrative therapy lens. And, you know, this is a culmination of a conversation we've been having for several months now, Bryson and I, about coming together and having a public conversation about our respective models. A lot of therapy models get caught in kind of echo chambers. They don't break out and kind of reach across party lines, so to speak, to have these kinds of conversations. So we're attempting to do that today. We know we are kind of at risk in our own therapeutic communities. By no means do I represent narrative therapy, and I'm not going to put that on Bryson either. By no means does he represent EFT. We are just two clinicians practicing in certain ways, really passionate about certain models of therapy, and we're just trying to have a conversation. So we know that we're not going to be able to make everybody happy, or we might even upset some people. But we're willing to take that risk to have this conversation, and I'm excited about it. So I would like to introduce some background on Bryson. Bryson Greaves is a colleague and a friend of mine. We met at Loma Linda University. He's a PhD student in marriage and family therapy, as am I. And he's an emotionally focused therapist. He practices that model. His research is around working with couples. He's a marriage and family therapist in practice at New Growth Counseling in Carlsbad, California. And for fun, he likes to surf, and he's actually had a long career as an international surf contest judge. He's traveled the world judging surf contests. He doesn't get to do it that much anymore because of a PhD program, but he's had a lot of fun doing that. So we are going to try and have a conversation. We're going to try and break through what Ken Gergen calls walls of containment, and in an effort to have some creative crosstalk. And I'm excited to have Bryson here to help along with that conversation. So without further ado, let's get to the conversation. So welcome, Bryson.
Thank you.
to the Radical Therapist Studios. Very excited that you're here. This is a conversation that we've been talking about having for quite some time. It was kind of taking various forms. We were going to try and do it in front of people and then whatever. And then I got started doing this podcast. So I thought, oh, let's bring Bryson into the podcast and kind of try to have this conversation between narrative therapy and emotionally focused therapy. And just for our listeners, what kind of drove this conversation Well, first of all, we are colleagues. Mm-hmm. We met in our doctoral program at Loma Linda University. We're both PhD students in marriage and family therapy. And
overworked, hardworking PhD student.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so we began, that's how we met, and we began to have these conversations. And I was really struck by the fact that you reminded me of me in some ways, that you had gone really, you were really interested in your model. You were doing the extensive training in your model, EFT. And I, you know, was also very going, you know, kind of going deep in my own model of narrative therapy. And I didn't know much about emotionally focused therapy, but then in class we began to have these conversations and, you know, mm-hmm. And I just was really, I think I was just more captured about how you talked about your work. And I think sometimes we get, I don't know, isolated in our models in some ways. And so there's not a lot of...
Sure. You find a home and then get stuck or don't venture out.
Yeah, kind of siloed in a way because you're just talking to narrative therapists, mm-hmm. or people that are interested in narrative practice. And so to have this kinds of conversation. But then I realized that other people were becoming curious about it. I was talking to a prominent narrative therapist in San Diego who remained nameless, but he was telling me that he was having this kind of thing going on in his program where his students were taking narrative therapy first and loving it, and then they would take the EFT class.
Like in another semester or something?
Yeah, the following semester, and they loved both models, and they were trying to figure out how to, you know, either integrate or, you know, eclecticism has become a bad word in our field, and so there's some talk about that not being kind of okay, and so there was some conflict, right, and some tension and some things, and he was telling me how he was going to, over this summer, take a bunch of EFT classes and read the books and just kind of get a feel for what's really going on in there. And I think in some ways that conversation gave me some permission to also do the same thing. And because we're so close, I thought that's when that conversation started about, you know, let's have a conversation about these two models and talk about them. And because we also had the same experience this summer. I taught narrative therapy at Loma Linda. You taught EFT at Loma Linda. Mm-hmm. And our students were saying a lot of the same things, right?
And actually taking the courses sort of consecutively or congruently. They were taking narrative and EFT both at the same time.
Yes. And I think you shared with me and I shared with you. I had students saying the same things. And they just didn't know kind of how to make sense of it or where it all fit, right? Mm-hmm. And so... and this isn't a conversation where we're looking to resolve something, right? Just kind of, you know, it's just an idea of like having a conversation. And for our listeners, before we came on air, Bryce and I were having this conversation that we both know we're kind of at risk here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And having this conversation that there's this idea in narrative therapy that like this, the panopticon of the narrative police, right? That in some ways... having this kinds of conversation, why am I commiserating with the enemy, so to speak? It could be characterized that way. And I know you had some kind of similar experience in conversations that you had. Or...
Sure. I think, partly I want to just start by saying I'm excited to be here and thank you for having me. It's a really good time to be able to do this with you. And it's something that I know we've been talking about for a really long time. And I think both of us have been so busy that just getting our schedules together has made it difficult. But
very much.
But I really do appreciate, I think, even just your commitment to having this conversation. And I think it's been sort of inspirational for me. And so it's a really nice opportunity to get to do this with you. But certainly, yeah, I think in our field, it is interesting. And there's a big debate that has probably gone on since... oh, I don't know, the 80s or 90s and continues to go on now, where sort of the model generation or creating models for therapy versus sort of what makes a good therapist in terms of properties of a therapist versus properties of a model. And so I think anytime we start to get really well trained in one model and identify with that model and build a community of members within that model, we in some ways are then taking a risk to sort of extend the olive branch out across models. It's exciting for, I think we're on an interesting playing field here.
Yeah. Well, and we can, and there's, you know, things we're exposing ourselves to. We could be accused of, you know, eclecticism or I don't know. What are some of these other ideas? We're just kind of but I'm also very interested in troubling ideas of this kind of fixedness of models. I am interested in epistemology and kind of crossing dialogues across epistemologies. I know people, you know, a colleague of mine, Vicky Dickerson, wrote an article that you can't really do that. But I don't know. I'm not so sure. And
well, and I think we're you and I are in a unique position of looking at this both from clinicians building a practice, but also as teachers of models and yes, introducing ourselves into the world of academics and teaching and writing about theory. So not just what is most effective clinically, but what's also most effective in terms of teaching therapy to incoming therapists.
Yes. which is part of my dissertation.
Which is some really great work. I hope that gets published here soon.
Soon, I hope.
Yeah. If I can just add one thing, because in preparing for this and the conversations we were having, we were and just sort of outlining how we would go about this. One of the things that came to mind is around models being real tools for marketing, right? And it makes sense that they have to be in our field, and there's trainings, and you and I have both done our respective kind of in-depth trainings in narrative and in EFT. So, but that debate that I was talking about still is very prominent, in which there's a whole nother field of common factors research.
Yeah.
People like Doug Sprinkle and Adrian Blow and Sean Davis are doing a massive amount of research around common factors that are sort of saying, not saying that we don't need models, but that we should be looking at where models overlap and the similarities of what makes good, effective therapists versus, you know, segregated models of change. That they're arguing sort of models, when they're able to accomplish these common factors, are effective, and different models vary in their degree to which they sort of accomplish those common factors.
Yeah.
But I think from a teaching standpoint, especially to the young students, it's important to consider where models overlap and teach from a factor driven, rather than asking students to maybe, you know, identify in a particular model camp so early on. I think that's where maybe the bad word of eclecticism sort of gets misplaced, is that, there are ways to maybe integrate, but if you become maybe too eclectic too early on, maybe it's, you don't have a good roadmap for where you're headed or how you're conceptualizing cases. So.
Yes. And I think that's that argument that I've heard somebody say, we should at least go deep in one theory, right? So then we can, gives us an idea about these others and where they sit on the epistemological spectrum. And so we're not doing maybe some sort of externalizing and internalizing in the same time or in the same session or something like that.
And, sure. And I think about learning models like learning a language. You know, I often talk to students about it. Like, when you go in depth and you learn one model deeply, the language of that model, you can sort of start to translate and learn other languages of other models.
Yeah.
And so I think when you know one model really well, be like, you know, having a really good fluency in Spanish, that French then maybe comes a little bit easier.
And Italian to, and on and on. Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. Great analogy. So we are holding the intention to kind of move. I've been, you know, very influenced by Dr. Anna Louise Keating at Texas Women's University and her ideas about post-oppositional ways of being. And this, I think, is we're kind of doing that. But I think one of the things we talked about is that we would talk about maybe some of the criticisms, because that comes up.
Sure.
And then we would get that up on both models, and then we would kind of get that, kind of set that aside, and then kind of have maybe a different kind of conversation, rather than get kind of stuck in the model rivalry conversation.
Yeah, or even find there may be opportunities in there to broaden the conversation around what that criticism is, to sort of look at it from a different lens. It's interesting. I was having a conversation with a student, and they were bringing up the sort of critiques of the different models.
Mm.
And it sort of dawned on me that the major proponents or the practitioners of a model often think what they see in that model as its greatest strength, and the people that then sort of exist outside of the model view what a model proponent says is its greatest strength as its greatest weakness.
Mm.
So for instance, EFT is heavily rooted in attachment theory, and that's one of the major critiques, is that we're sort of in this realm of like deterministic traitology, I guess, if you will, of using psychological theories of a way of being that then become too deterministic. Yet for those of us in the EFT community, see that as one of its greatest strengths. And I think the same could be argued for almost every model out there, that what the people believe who are doing the model is the model's greatest strengths is often what is most criticized by people who sit outside the model.
Well, and and you raise a great point, because my experience or my limited knowledge of EFT was, you know, I'd read a Nyland Tilson article where they critiqued a couple of models, but one of them, or not the model, but actually attachment theory. Mm-hmm. And I think it was from the, you know, the feminist lens that, you know, that it practice, it could produce, you know, a lot of like mother blame and this kind of unbalanced thing. But that, and that's one of the things that interests me when I taught, when I began to talk to you and I kind of got what would, narrative would call it more experience near kind of idea of how you, how it informed your work. Mm-hmm. It began to kind of trouble that idea, right? A little bit, because you were, you know, there was some attending to some of these things. I guess I just had, once you, and this is one of the things that I'm struggling with, and I'm thinking about in my own work and being affected by Bruno Latour and his ideas around critique and how it kind of moves you away, and you can move from how narrative might critique instant psychoanalysis, you know, of making these claims about people really quickly and these kinds of things, that we're maybe moving now to a, kind of what Bruno Latour would call an instant sociology, right? That we kind of make these kind of critical claims from a distance without, you know, much curiosity. And that's one of the things that when I began to talk to you, I began to realize, well, maybe there's something different going on here. Mm-hmm. And so maybe, I mean, how do you attend to larger social contexts or what, you know, with some of these things?
Yeah. So I think, well, from an EFT lens or from an attachment informed lens, you know, Bowlby, I think, when John Bowlby was developing attachment theory, and then later, you know, Mary Main, Mary Ainsworth, and more contemporary people like Patricia Crittenden, they've sort of always acknowledged context. It sort of goes under-recognized, I think, in terms of, because it, in a large part, I think, attachment theory got picked up in the field of psychology, which has more of like a, I guess, an individualistic sort of linear view at times, whereas us as marriage and family therapists are so much more sort of engaged in the systemic way of thinking, holistic practice. And so, you know, I think that for that reason, attachment theory maybe has gotten this idea that sort of it didn't attend to larger context. But when you, if you think about attachment, if for a lot of EFT theorists and practitioners, we think about attachment as really a theory of adaptation. How did somebody adapt to their environment and end up engaging their external surroundings in ways that made sense to them? So sort of to borrow from narrative language, right? How was that narrative created? How did they start to see themselves in existence with their environment and the relationships around them? And that's really what we started to talk about in terms of attachment versus trait, like you are avoidant or you are anxious or something. EFT has really worked to get away from labeling and away from the deterministic traits, but rather looking at how does this make sense in this person's context, right? How does this, how does their behavior, how does their function, how does their view of the world really make sense to them in the context that they are sort of engaging with? And so I think, in that way, to answer your question, like in terms of larger social context, it's sort of always woven in where we're viewing this person in relation to, you know, the sort of the mesosystem, the macro, you know. So we're looking at multiple levels of interaction when we're talking with people from an attachment lens.
Yeah, and I guess maybe I should ask you what was your experience of narrative, or what was a common critique you heard of narrative?
Yeah. Well, I guess for me, and certainly being in a PhD program and moving toward the academic side of things, one of the biggest critiques that I hear often is narrative not having the grounding in research.
Yeah.
Yet. Then to go back to my argument from earlier, right, that's one of the biggest strengths that probably people within the narrative community would argue that it is one of the biggest strengths of narrative is that it hasn't engaged in the sort of biasing of research data that so much of the other critique for other models lands on. It's not prescriptive.
For sure.
And yet then, so like somebody like myself who sits outside of like narrative training, that's a critique that I hear often, which is like, you know, it doesn't have the evidence-based literature support.
Yeah, and I think, you know, most people within the community would say, well, of course, that's totally congruent with our, you know, our theoretical foundation around post-structuralism and the idea that, you know, N equals one and... Mm-hmm. You know, one person's experience is as valid as an N equals 200 or something like that. You know, what discounts that person's authority of their own story, their own life, those kinds of things. So, but I've also noticed that in the community, there's this kind of pragmatism. Is that the right word?
Pragmatism?
Pragmatism.
I don't know how many T's are in there.
And I'm kind of interested in that because I know Michael White before, the last few times I've listened to Michael White and these were talks, was referring to William James, which in my early training in narrative, I didn't know that. And I'm kind of a fan of William James, and he talks about, I think, radical pragmatism and this idea. And I think I would be really curious what might have continued on if, you know, Michael were still alive in that way, but I'm beginning to see parts of the community kind of at risk and being critiqued, embracing research. And I'm thinking specifically of John Stillman in Minnesota and his work with the VA around PTSD and narrative, right, and doing that pilot study and showing effectiveness. And, you know, it's just a pilot study, small sample size, but you're beginning to see this kind of movement towards, or this embracing of, or this kind of wading into the research world. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, that you're seeing other, I think I'm drawing a blank now, but there are others, and I'll post maybe some links on the show notes when we do it. But it's been a, you know, valid critique, from a place, but I think inside the community, they would say, well, yeah, like it's our strongest strength, right? Like you said, so.
Right. Yeah. It's a very, it's an interesting dynamic, thinking about people within the model, thinking that it's, or sort of experiencing the critique as really the model strength.
Well, I think it feeds into another critique I'm aware of narrative, and that is that idea of its isolationism, you know, this idea that we're really different than everybody else, and we just don't even pay attention to what anybody else is doing. We're just kind of going on in our way. And there, I think there is some validity to that criticism. You know, that I think as therapists, I think we should be better, especially narrative therapists. I think we should be, I don't know if we should be accused of isolationism, because that's something we're always taking on in our work. And, and I think we're really, the critique I've heard is that we're really great about multiplicity and in the room, but when we step outside of the therapy room, not so much, right? We're kind of, you know, get stuck to these fixed ideas about our practice, and it has this effect, these effects on people outside of our community in some ways,
which is understandable when you have something that sort of anecdotally, like to you, it makes sense either through personal experience or experience in the therapy chair, where you've had really sort of good outcomes with clients where they've really connected with you and connected with the work that you've done, and it's been helpful for them. I mean, some would argue that's really the only sort of research data support we need for what we're doing. But I think then the other sort of side of the coin, when you're looking at, I mean, we're in this era of managed care and all these different things, and having to write case notes in really specific ways, especially if you're at agency work. And so I think for students, it can be difficult because sort of to go along those lines, but where narrative doesn't sort of have the prescriptive, they haven't done the sort of mechanisms of change research to look at sort of, do we really know what makes things change for a client in their experience and things, and that,
And other models have done that, but then that takes the risk of they're more prescriptive. They tend to be written out on paper as more linear. And that's certainly one of the critiques of EFT. Although in Sue's writing, she certainly does make the space for sort of the recursive aspects of EFT that you can kind of go through steps and stages, but you're never really kind of doing it linearly. There's certainly ways to go through that model in a systemic way or sort of a reoccurring way.
Yeah, you bring up a point for me, because I've always wondered, you know, I always felt our community was really good at carrying the critical lens, but not so much at being really reflective about, and maybe I'm opening myself up to some critique here, but maybe being reflective about our own work. And I heard, you know, there's this movement now in the community that I heard about kind of putting a moratorium on maps. You know, Michael White was really big on the map metaphor and statement of position maps and these kinds of things. And I think there was some speaking to your thing, that there was some critique that there's this kind of thing building, this linear, like, this is how it's supposed to look kind of thing and narrative. And they wanted to kind of move away from the map metaphor. But I also would challenge that by, you know, anybody that reads Michael White, maps of narrative practice doesn't really understand it anyway. It's really
I have it sitting on my desk. I pick it up every once in a while, and I probably read 10 pages and I reread the same 10 pages. Yeah. So
I wonder if that's really coming from like three people in the community that have some power in how it's talked about. But and I really do like the map metaphor and have found it very valuable in my own practice, and not as a fixed way of practice, but as or a linear way, but it just, you know, keeping me from getting lost in the room in the messy work of therapy, right? And so it just,
and the proponents of sort of the common factors research, Doug Sprinkle and these people, sort of that's their advocacy toward models, is models provide a map. Like, how do you know the road that you're on? We need those models, especially when we feel stuck in the therapy room. We have something to go back to, at least some part of like a therapist comfort zone, where it's like, wow, this just happened and I sort of got derailed, or and I need to be able to bring myself back to a common understanding that I'm familiar with, to be able to sort of, I think, continue to work in that way or work effectively. So for you, that's narrative. For me, that's EFT. And, and that's where I think so much of the commonality is.
So continuing the critique conversation, I guess I want to make a statement here that I forgot to make at the beginning of the conversation, and that was, by no means are we representing the respective models.
No, I'm certainly not speaking for Sue Johnson.
And I don't want to, you know, and I would never ask anybody of that, to any guest of mine to come in and represent people or a model or anything like that. And I don't want that responsibility either, but these are more just our own personal experiences. So I wanted to be clear about that as we continued on, especially as we're talking about some critiques. But
a critique of EFT that I often hear coming from students and other people in the model, sort of, I guess, the delineation being the critique of the model in and of itself, which we sort of talked a little bit about, and then the critique maybe of the model in practice, like what they're seeing the therapist do. And often what they're talking about, or the critiques that I hear from students, is that they will hear EFT therapists in what sounds like they're speaking for the client. So like in terms of like identifying primary emotion, those sort of core emotions, sadness, hurt, fear, they may hear the EFT therapist sort of use an intervention, what we call an empathic conjecture, where we're sort of walking step by step, side by side with the client and their experience. And then over time, we might take one step out in front and identify sort of a next rung down on the ladder, if you will, around like an emotional experience or an attachment significant reframe or something like this. And what therapists who are watching that often say is sometimes they'll experience the EFT therapist speaking for the client. And I think it's a valid critique. I've heard Sue talk about this, that certainly it has to be done through attunement. And if we think about EFT was sort of developed a lot alongside or through Rogerian sort of psychology and using Carl Rogers' work. And Rogers talked a lot about attunement, and he sort of talked about attunement as going beyond what you would just see or hear from a client, but really empathically sort of running their experience through you. I mean, Rogers talked often about trying to get as close to the client's experience as possible.
True.
Very different than sort of the blank slate therapist of the day.
For sure.
And so I think when Sue or EFT therapists are using empathic conjectures, it's coming from a place of attunement. At least that's the intent, that we are trying to attune to our client's experience and process and get as close to that as possible, so that when we make an empathic conjecture, we hopefully would be correct, right? We wouldn't want to mislead, but we also create space. And I think you, in Sue's work, this is something that I continuously challenge myself on. When she makes an empathic conjecture, she immediately makes space for change. She immediately makes space to be wrong, for her as the therapist to be wrong, and asks the clients to help her understand their experience or correct her if she's wrong. And so, you know, I think that's some of the nuance that happens that just a very skilled therapist is able to do. So it is certainly a critique that the EFT therapist may speak for the client, but from the Rogerian sort of attunement sort of lens, there's real reasons for doing that.
Yeah, and I you know, quite honestly, and I mean, if you talk to another narrative person, or then you might get a different answer, but it sounds very similar to work I've seen in narrative practice, where, you know, somebody might be struggling with naming it or naming a problem, and because these things are familiar, not the person not familiar, but these problems tend to be familiar to, as maybe the way the narrative therapist would language it. You know, this idea of if problems talked, and, you know, we bump into a lot of them and we kind of know how they operate, et cetera, et cetera. We don't try and take that position with people, but we would tentatively suggest, could it be this, or could it possibly be something like this? And also with that space, that very tentatively, right? Not from a place of authority or it is this, you know, but just so that doesn't sound, I guess some of our practices could be critiqued in that same way. But I wanted to talk about, you know, another one that I often hear practice-wise. I think we're going to move into talking about students and some of the things that one of the most common questions I get from students when they're introduced to narrative practice is, you know, there's this idea of the therapist being influential but decentered, right? And there's this always, it comes up pretty consistently, this idea of, well, how do you hold somebody accountable, right? And
in terms of client,
or
therapist,
if there's some sort of, you know, bad behavior going on, how do you, not so much the therapist, but how do you, you know, this idea of accountability, you know, this kind of Western idea, but, and so, I don't, you know, I'm trying to think, you know, it's not about holding accountable ability, but it's about inviting people into accountability and making that kind of space that you spoke to.
Can I ask a question, like a follow-up? Because that's a piece for me that maybe I'm interested in narrative is, so in EFT, we'd have this, that's where we would be sort of attachment informed. What we see from a person, regardless of how maybe unlikable or undesirable that my action might be or behavior might be, we're understanding it in terms of attachment. How did this behavior function well for this person, maybe in a different context, whether that was for individual survival or whatever it was, speaking maybe about trauma or something like this, that then in a relational context, what they did as an adaptation to survive now becomes somewhat damaging to a relationship, right? And so that's where we're attachment informed. Mm-hmm. So we would say, and Sue has talked about this and wrote really nicely about it in a lot of her books, but that we, if we work as the therapist to understand the person's context really hard, any behavior can make sense. It doesn't mean it might be functioning for them in the way that they want that would be congruent with their sort of overall goals.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm curious.
So there's a move away from pathology or...
Very much so, yeah. Right. And so I guess, and I think in that sense, attachment theory, we would argue, is inherently depathologizing. Mm. That we're saying there is an interaction between the interpersonal and the interpsychic that's going on, and how was that created environmentally? Mm. So I guess I'm curious for narrative, like, in that moment, like, what would inform the narrative therapist when they maybe see something that is damaging or difficult for a client that they're struggling with? And you're talking about accountability. What would sort of inform the narrative therapist at that moment?
Well, I think it would, you know, kind of be larger social discourse, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of times in couples work, and this is just for me, listening audience, you know, you talk to anybody else, you might get a different answer. This idea that in a couple's relationship, you know, you have certain ways of being, which EFT might call pursuer withdrawer or something like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas a narrative, we would look through it at the lens of patriarchal practices, right? Mm. How men are culturally sanctioned to operate in relationships and what ways of being they have access to, and how patriarchal practices or hegemonic masculinity or some of these things kind of shut down possibilities for men, or ways of men can be in relationship.
Mm-hmm. Limits
heterosexual relationships.
Limits the possibility. So whether that's around emotional expression, power hierarchy, that's the kinds of things.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we would probably be looking at it through that lens. Mm-hmm, right. Mm-hmm. And then through externalizing, you could say mistrust is operating on a relationship, and you happen to be interviewing the female partner of a heterosexual relationship and asking about effects of mistrust and its influence on her life and the relationship's life. And while the male partner is in a kind of witnessing position, you know, not having to defend or being able to just to kind of listen in and see the effects. And then you can kind of ask about the impact of these effects on where did it take him? What was his response to this? And would he want it to be a different way? And, you know, and through that process, begin to, rather than, you know, it's asking him about taking on mistrust rather than other kind of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how might he be able to do that? Or
sure,
in a simplistic nutshell.
Okay, yeah, and that's I guess maybe where the difference of the two models can really come in, and where the underpinning of attachment theory for the EFT therapist really, really moves in to sort of inform us. Because I think for us, I wouldn't say we don't look at sort of the larger social context, but that's not probably in that moment what's informing us.
Sure.
So for me, the attachment theory piece steps in and says, you know, like, let's say the male partner in this couple that you're describing is more shut down or withdrawn, and his female partner is, you know, adamant that she's being hurt by this, and that it's unacceptable to her and damaging to the relationship or whatnot. We're sort of looking at how the cycle between them, what she is getting upset about and what he's doing with that when he sees it. Where does he go sort of internally? Does he go to, here we go again, I just can't get it right with her, and I really, really want to, but I don't even know where to start. And so I get terrified that, you know, I'm going to lose her or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And then that's what creates the shutdown. Or is it like, here she goes. She flew off the handle again, and I'm just not even going to say anything because I'm only going to make it worse. Mm-hmm. So in that moment, we're letting the attachment frame try and guide us to understand his context or his sort of, I guess, maybe internal landscape. What are his perceptions? What's he saying about himself in those moments? Because ultimately, we're looking at things like fear. What do people do when they get afraid,
sure,
or hurt or sad or they feel despaired, you know? So that's where, you know, and I think EFT literature certainly does use labels like pursue withdrawal. Yeah. But I think when you talk to people, namely Jim Furrow, who's up at Pasadena, he talks a lot about the difference between state versus trait. And I think in EFT, we're using terms like pursue withdrawal to describe what happens, right? Like, what are the go-to sort of action tendencies of a person in their relational context, rather than it's defining their personality or their character, okay, or something like this. So yeah. I tend to believe, or I tend to use terms like they move toward withdrawal, yeah, rather than, yeah, they are the withdrawer.
Yeah. So there's some externalizing in that.
Certainly.
Which I think there's some misunderstanding about that, because I think somebody from a distance might see that there's this labeling going on and this is kind of a trait, right? It gets talked about in that way because that's how we talk about things in our culture.
And attachment theory in psychology has certainly produced that narrative and strengthened that narrative. Yeah. I mean, you have the ABCD model of attachment that is very deterministic.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not challenging psychology's research on that. It's huge. It's a wide, scaled research, but I think we use it in a more dynamic way rather than deterministic way.
Which is, you know, something new for me is the way you talk about it, that there is this kind of differentiation between psychology and this MFT or relational way of working with attachment theory, which I don't know if most people would
agree with that.
Yeah, or know about it, really. I don't know about agree with it. It moves me closer to it, right?
Yeah.
Because I was used to the whole psychology piece and this kind of way of talking about people and very deterministic, and, you know, that trait talk, and which, you know, but you're talking in a more kind of very relational, social relational way, right?
Well, and to be sure, I mean that's maybe a, when we're talking about that argument, that's maybe one that is slightly out of date. I mean, I think psychology and MFT are probably moving slightly closer together than widening any sort of gap. I guess I don't have any proof of that other than I would like to believe that that's happening. Back in the day when we're talking Freudian psychology and then sort of maturing through that, I think the systems way of thinking, right, became very different. But I talk to a lot of psychologists now, and I actually trained under psychologists in my earliest trainings, and they were very systems oriented and relationally mindful in terms of interaction sequences and things, not just sort of look at this behavior and let's describe it as pathology or something like this.
Sure.
And I actually had a couple psychology students in my EFT class up at Loma Linda this last quarter, and they were terrific just in terms of what they were able to add with a different lens. But I think there's so much overlap. I mean, we were talking about overlaps in models, but overlaps in fields too that should be looked at.
Sure, sure.
You mentioned your friend who has had the experience of sort of students being taught one model at one time and then sort of reversing that in their course curriculum to see if the outcomes were any different in terms of students sort of aligning with one model more than another or something like that. Yeah. And I think in teaching models, and I really enjoy having this conversation with you because this is like this is your area of research. So this is really nice. But, you know, I think what what EFT offers in the prescriptive aspect, steps and stages, is somewhat easy to follow. Doesn't mean that in practice, I mean, certainly I'm trying every day and growing and making lots of mistakes, but it does give me an outline of like where I can head, right? And yeah. and some logical sort of description of like why one step becomes first before another.
Yeah.
And then going beyond that, there's mechanisms of change research that sort of support different steps and stages, and we've looked at outcomes and things like that. So on the one hand, it's prescriptive and that's a critique, but on the other hand, I think it can make it easier to teach. I've never taught narrative, so I'm asking more than saying, but in my experience, students who were taking narrative with you and EFT with me, that those were some of the comments I was getting was, you know, they really love the principles and the sort of the critical lens and the social context part of narrative, but that it was harder for them to sort of latch on to what they felt like was more abstract.
Yeah.
And then having this idea of there was a right and a wrong way, and with narrative feeling like, boy, I'm doing it the wrong way because I'm not following that outline, or I'm not
right.
sort of, and I guess I would just be curious what your experience has been.
Which is a really great question, and something that I've been wrestling with, obviously, because of my research. And just for those that are listening, I am doing my dissertation on teaching and learning in family therapy around epistemologies and teaching epistemologies to students. But the thing that I've kind of, two things have happened recently, and that is doing my dissertation, and also that have kind of helped me, but also teaching for John Winslade and Lorraine Headke, two prominent narrative therapists at Cal State San Bernardino. They were my bosses, and I had a chance to teach an advanced counseling class with them. And they're a narrative program in their counseling program at Cal State San Bernardino. And for some reason, you know, watching them work gave me, and I hope it's okay that I say this, they can write me and complain.
Yeah, you're outed now.
I'm outed now, yeah. But I really watched, they gave me permission to be more direct. Two things happened. You know, really getting kind of immersed in Vygotsky and educational theory, Lev Vygotsky. And also teaching
scaffolding,
his idea of scaffolding, primarily kind of scaffolding from the known and familiar to the possible to know, and working with John and Lorraine. And what I saw with John and Lorraine when I was teaching advanced counseling with them is that they were very kind of directive in the beginning phases about trying to provide a map for students. Because it can be very, in some ways, very abstract. And so working with John and Lorraine gave me some permission in my own work and in teaching and even in training at California Family Institute, and that to kind of step into a more kind of directive, I guess is the word, teaching style in the beginning. And true to scaffolding, it was like this idea of kind of being more directive in the beginning, then kind of being very collaborative in the middle, and then kind of just backing away towards the end, and letting people take this process where they can, which is a difficult process to do, right? And what I learned, though, is that, you know, I used to want to be really collaborative, and I felt if I stepped into any kind of directive way of being, I wasn't being true to narrative principles or those kinds of things. But I went and did my research at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, and you know, I sat with a new group of marriage and family therapy students and did some focus groups in the beginning of their semester and at the end of their semester. And they were really struggling with, you know, because, you know, Lewis and Clark is a very progressive program,
right.
Liberation and critical theory and social justice oriented. And they were really, same thing, like I get with a lot of new students in narrative, very struggling with the ideas, being destabilized, not having much to hold on to. And in some ways I felt that was kind of disservice is the right word, but I think something had to be, that it was through Vygotsky and scaffolding theory. I think it gives you permission in the foundational stages to be more helpful. And it's okay to be a little directive and trust that people will over time find out what works for them and what doesn't work for them. And they'll get to a, and then you can collaboratively work with them through that as they have questions. Mm. And then eventually they'll get to a place where their work fits them and their worldview and the way that they want to work and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So.
Yeah, it does. Well, as you're talking, it reminds me of, so like how attachment and how John Bowlby would talk about a very similar principle. Bowlby wrote about the stronger, wiser other. That
I'm familiar with that idea. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that like in early stage development or early stage life, there is protection, there is survivability, there is healthy adaptation or whatnot within this idea of the stronger, wiser other. And I think back to like me in statistics class, right? We took statistics together.
Yes, we did.
And had I gone to our professor, who was a terrific stats professor.
Wonderful.
If I had gone to him in that moment and said, I'm really struggling here. I don't know what to do. And he said, yeah, me neither. Just kind of do whatever. Right. Like if I would have panicked or I would have felt completely incompetent or unsupported or whatever.
Yeah.
But what I think he was able to do and what I later sort of in through reading Bowlby and Vygotsky and things, he was able to engage us in that way where like early on in our first couple weeks, quarters, he was able to really sit with us and say, you know, try this out in a more directive way. Mm-hmm. And then if I think back through the process to really the end of our stats career at there, at least in terms of the educational process, was basically all of us sitting around in a circle and being very collaborative and talking about each other's work. So naturally, I think we moved through exactly what you're researching and what philosophers have talked about in terms of scaffolding learning. Mm. But it's interesting for me that like, I mean, Bowlby, I think did write about these things too. He wrote them in about them in a different context, maybe not learning and things, but certainly, in terms of adaptation and what is safe and effective and healthy and for, safety more than anything. I think you can feel safe when somebody says like, I got this, you know, you may not right now, but you will. Mm. And I'll carry this until you feel more comfortable. So I think that's probably a good model for education, supervision.
Yeah. In general.
Parenting.
Yeah. And in my dissertation, I take it through like postmodern practices and critical theory and the scaffold of all, and even research informed, what I call research informed. And so that's the work. So I have a question for you in regards to teaching, and I guess, and it's around emotion, and this is just out of my own really curiosity, that I get the sense that emotion is important, right, in the practice, and in narrative practice, I like Michael White's idea of catharsis, but the old Greek idea of catharsis that, you know, you can go to a Greek tragedy, and if at the end of that thing you're in new territory, you've been transformed, or you're looking at your life in different ways, or kind of just been rearranged in some ways, then that's kind of a form of catharsis rather than, I think, Freudian ways of catharsis.
Just emotional, emoting.
Emoting, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Different.
Right.
Two different uses of the word, yeah.
Yeah, and so, and I think, once again, speaking for my own practice, not for everybody, but my own practice, I think we were more interested in that kind of catharsis about transportation to new territory, these kinds of things. And emotion doesn't come up that much, right? Mm. And sometimes we don't trust it. You know, somebody, an old supervisor of mine said once, you know, is it emotion of the problem, right? Sometimes I think you get new therapists and they think, oh, they cried in session. It was a good session.
Mm-hmm.
And just kind of because somebody had, you know, tapped into some emotion. And I don't know. I'm just kind of being really curious. But I mean, how important is emotion in EFT, right?
Very. but it's not all, right? But I think I'm thinking back to, again, common factors where we sort of, the argument is made that all models work on cognition, behavior, and emotion. Mm. And Don Bockham over in North Carolina wrote a paper specifically around couple therapy, around like IBCT, integrated behavioral couple therapy, CBCT, cognitive behavioral therapy, EFT, insight-oriented couple therapy, where he basically discussed sort of the difference in terms of prioritizing, whether it's cognitive thinking, emotion or behavior, and how each model sort of privileges one of those three pillars, right? And so for EFT, we certainly would privilege emotion on the understanding that emotion is the leading edge of our experience. And we EFT draws on some neuropsych research, Jim Cohen, Yak Pangsep, who does a lot of studies around emotion and identifying emotion globally, like universal emotions. So we use that to inform our practice. So we're certainly keyed into the emotional language and looking at different levels of emotion. So secondary emotion being things like frustration, jealousy, anger. These things, it's not that they are not emotions. They very much are. We would say that they are reactive emotions. They are the emotions that sort of are easiest to express. And then you have the below surface or the deeper level emotions, call those primary emotions, which are things like, you know, sadness, hurt, fear, the things that sometimes can jolt all of us when we start talking about them. And in EFT, we're saying when we can get people down to those primary emotions and that they can start to talk about them and experience them and understand what how those primary emotions drive their behavior, their thinking, or things, and that they can take risks in sharing those primary emotions with their partner or with somebody else who is open, accessible, and responsive, that can be healing. So it's more than catharsis. We're actually wanting to make emotional expression transformative.
And then
the other part of EFT is the experiential piece. So where our understanding would be that change in and of itself will not come from new cognition, new ways of thinking, that we have to actually engage in the experiential. Very Virginia Satir and Gestalt and those types of
interesting
ideas, where it's sort of like the experience here is maybe the highest form of learning, where when we can shape a new experience, we have a new understandings of ourselves and the external world or the surrounding environment.
Okay. Well, thank you. Okay. So we're at about an hour, but I want to just kind of maybe say, will you come back?
I would love to. Yeah.
So this is a conversation that I'm really enjoying having, and I would love to continue to have, and I'm sure people that are listening probably, hopefully found a lot of value in it too. So maybe next time we can come, we'll figure something out, but we'll continue this conversation. And, you know, who knows where it'll take us, but
or if people who are listening have questions, it'd be great if they could write them in or let us know, text, call, I don't know.
Great point. And I'll give all that information on the closing piece and how to contact us. And we would love your questions. You can always go to the website, theradicaltherapist.com. We're on Twitter at The Rad Therapist. We're on Podbean at The Radical Therapist and Instagram at The Radical Therapist. So we would love to hear from you if you have questions about either narrative or EFT or both, or questions just for us or general, whatever kinds of questions, please let us know. And we would love to answer them and get at them. So thanks for taking the risk.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for allowing the space for the risk to be taken.
Yeah, thanks for coming and taking the risk and having this conversation with me. And I look forward to doing it again.
Yeah, wonderful.
Thanks, Bryson.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, that's our show. I want to really thank you for listening. Please spread the word. Go on to iTunes, subscribe to us, rate and review us. We would really appreciate it. You can also find us at theradicaltherapist.com. And please, like we said, send us some questions at our email, theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. It will help as we have these future conversations with Bryson and myself. We can kind of tend to your questions. I think it'll be really fun. And we hope you get involved. So please, like I said, keep an eye out for us. We really appreciate you listening. And thank you very much.